Radio City, episode number 37. John Grace and Rob Ross here with you, hanging out and talking about, well, a little bit of everything. And boy, is there a lot to talk about this week. We've got some music for you, some politics, and who knows what else might come up. Rob Ross, how's everything in New York City?
So far, so good. You know, it's a really magnificent day here. It is, I believe it reached a high of 73 degrees.
Wow.
After spending the last week and a half wearing heavier jackets than I was accustomed to. But, you know, obviously really nice autumn weather came on, but today was a welcome change, oddly enough. Global warming? What global warming?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's 80 degrees was the high in St. Louis today. And tomorrow, of course, it's going to be 61. So everybody will be sick by the end of the week, hacking and coughing.
Well, let's not hack and cough. Let us cheer and whoop for the new world champions, the Houston Astros.
How about it? $149 million salary as opposed to $265 for the LA Dodgers. And Houston rises up, and in Game 7, they take that thing. And I'll tell you, after all of the amazing games that happened in 1 through 6, 7 was kind of dull. I mean, after the second inning, it was about over.
It was right. It was over in the second inning. The fact that they pummeled Darvish twice spoke volumes to me. I think Houston showed an incredible amount of heart.
Yes.
More than anything else. Resilience, you'd better believe it. Grit, absolutely. And the unabashed arrogance of the fans and of the media as far as, oh, the Dodgers are going to win this in a walk. You know, people really need to learn to be quiet. They really do. Every pundit always winds up with his foot firmly planted where a molar should be. No sweeter was watching and listening to Joe Buck cringe when he had to say, and the Houston Astros are the world champions.
Yeah.
Because he was doing this whole, and the Dodgers can come back right up to the ninth inning. Joe Buck is possibly the biggest fool in sports broadcasting. My loathing of that man has reached a new apex. I've hated him for years because he's such a homer and hates the Mets.
Yeah.
So, of course, whenever he's broadcasting a nationally televised game that the Mets are involved in, he takes no restraint in knocking them somehow. Even if they're winning 14-0, he's going to, you know, make it sound like they're on the cusp of losing the game. So, nuts to you, Joe Buck.
Well, yeah, and as one more reason, the very first time that I ever ran into Joe outside of work, and it was few and far between when I was working for the Cardinals radio station, that I would run into Joe in the hallways sometimes. His dad was always around, and I'll tell you, Jack will always be, in my mind, what a human being should be, or should aspire to, because nobody can be like Jack Buck. But Joe was a little more absent, and the first place I ever ran into him outside of work by accident was at Starbucks. So what does that tell you?
That he's a yutz.
Yeah. So now with Houston, though, the great thing about this, and I was pondering this, the fantastic nature of a 7-game series and especially of a game 7, because there's a beauty in the fact that the natural inclination would be to say that the team that has home field advantage, that plays the two first and the two last, is going to have the natural advantage. But what that leaves is it leaves a situation where exactly what happened has to happen for the away team, where they win 2 out of 3 at home and then split on the road. And if you can pull that off, that's where the advantage comes back, and it sort of evens itself out, because all you have to do outside of your own stadium is earn a split, and you can still win the thing. So Houston did exactly what they had to do all the way along, and that amazing game that went 5.5 hours with all of those lead changes. And think about this, a 5.5 hour game in 10 innings. There were, I don't know how many pitchers they went through in that game.
Special. That's kind of standard issue with the American League. Honestly, is another reason why I despise the American League and why I won't watch an American League game if there's nothing else on.
Right.
Because it's so slowly paced.
Right, right. And there was a little something extra special about it, because we happened to spend most of the week outside of Game 7 in Cooperstown, New York, in the home of the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame. And even though it's off season and even though most of the tourists are gone, there's still such a great affection for that place, and you run into somebody a little bit from everywhere, and the entire town was done up in the colors of both teams, and it was cool to be there during World Series week in a time when the place isn't overrun with fans. You know, it's not the middle of summer, it's not induction day or anything else like that. It's just, while the series is going on, that's really what Cooperstown is all about. They love it there.
Well, there's a couple of things that, about what you just said that made me think right away. First of all, the Astros have those nice fall colors.
Yes.
You know, that's number one. So that's really very apt. Second of all, love them or hate them, the Dodgers originally belonged to New York. They were a Brooklyn team. So, mm-hmm. Of course, Dodger blue is always going to be part of the fabric in New York regardless. And just the idea of going to a place like Cooperstown, where it's such a warm and embracing kind of place, I've always felt, and filled with history, not just with the Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum, but there's, if I'm not mistaken, this wonderful farming museum up there as well. And
right.
If memory serves, and if it's still there after 40 years was the last time I was there, believe it or not. Ironically enough, it was the week that Elvis Presley had passed away.
Oh, wow.
That was when we went up there. Cooperstown is almost to me like the perfect small southern town.
Yeah.
Which I've always felt comfortable in.
Right. It has a lot of that feel, except for the fact that, as you said, those fall colors were on display, not just with the Astros colors, but all over the mountainsides. And it's situated at the southern tip of Lake Otsego. And the lake itself is kind of like, it's not in the Finger Lakes, but it's that same kind of shape. It's just one, you know, north-south kind of affair. And you drive all the way around the lake, and it's just gorgeous as far as the eye can see. And it is a very, I mean, Cooperstown itself is tiny, but it's still, I mean, the history outstrips even the Major League Baseball part of it, because right outside the Baseball Hall of Fame is a statue. And that statue is James Fenimore Cooper of the Leather Stocking Tales. That's who the town is named after, is his family. That's why it's Cooperstown. So there's so much more than just that. But even that farming museum, by the way, is still there. And we went, and it was almost empty because it was a cold day. I think we went on Sunday. And it was kind of chilly, and it was overcast, and there was us and maybe two or three other couples there. And we're walking around and ran into a guy tending one of the gardens. And we asked him what it was that he was growing in there, and it just looked like a bunch of herbs and plants and things, and it turns out that's what it was. The building next to the garden is the pharmacy, the old style, you know, done up in, I don't know, 1850s-ish era. And the plants that he was growing were the things that really would have been growing next to the pharmacy, that the pharmacist would have made all of the cures out of. We ended up talking to this guy for about an hour about all of the things that were there and how it all morphed into the drugs that are on the store shelves now when you go to Walgreens or Rite Aid or whatever. And he was so happy about it, and he was so into the whole thing, and had this book that was a sort of a, almost like a physician's desk reference, but far before that, from the 1840s. And it had names in it that still, names like Merck, which is still a massive pharmaceutical conglomerate today. And it shows how long those companies have been around and how long they've been in business. And in fact, that company that became Merck was in business in the 1600s. So the things that we think of as relatively new, the patent medicines and all of that, were derived from guys like him out tending these plants next to their pharmacies 200, 300, 400 years ago.
A tip of the hat to the apothecary.
There you go. But it was, that's the thing. You find somebody who's that into their thing, and they can make it interesting to anybody.
I wonder if there's any kind of correlation or a kinship between that little pharmaceutical museum of sorts.
Yeah.
And the pharmacy museum in New Orleans on Chartres Street, because
right.
And it's the same premise. It's, you know, suddenly you walked into the 1800s, you know, the creaky wooden floors that are rotting, and everything's just, you know, wood desks and tables and shelving and the old square bottles with the handwritten labels that are fading away. And,
right.
You know, it's, it's a fascinating thing. So I'm glad you had a chance to enjoy yourself and to come back to the homeland, because you are, after all, one of the New York brethren.
Yes.
And the funny thing is that we're both New Yorkers, but from two totally different ends of New York. You're from up there, and I'm from down here, which to most people who really don't think about it in depth, New York outside of the five boroughs is such a different world. When you go into, quote, New York State itself, it is so rich and lush and beautiful and picturesque. And the fact that you can drive from where I am 5 hours and still be in the same state, you know, my mind always says, if you're going to drive for 5 hours, you better head south, because you'll hit at least six different states on the way down.
Right. Yeah, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland. Yeah, keep going. But yeah,
it by six. Yeah.
And I'll tell you, there, it is beautiful, and there's so much out there, but there are some places in rural New York outside of Cooperstown. There's two ways to get back to Albany, and along the southern route, I'll tell you, there are some places there that would freak out Eddie Gein. I mean, it's scary, but you know, it was Halloween time, so it deserved to be. And yeah, I highly recommend it. There's so much there. And Hyde Hall, we did a ghost tour, and it was great. It was great. So if you've never been to Cooperstown, here's a funny thing. While we were walking around, we had to go and buy a souvenir for somebody my wife works with. And she said, I have to get this for him because he will never come here. And it's because his wife hates baseball. And I said, can you tell her about all the other stuff there is here? It has nothing to do with baseball. She said she doesn't care. She just won't, because it has that image. But I'll tell you, even if you never watched a ball game in your life and you go to Cooperstown, you'll have a blast.
Well, there are people on Facebook, because, you know, Facebook is the haven for those who are all-knowing.
Right, sure.
Who are saying, well, I've never watched a baseball game in my life, you know. And all I can think was, you're so unbelievably full of shit, it's not even funny. You're from New York.
Uh-huh.
Don't dare.
Right.
Don't pull that holier-than-thou jazz with me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not having any of it. And it doesn't matter if you don't have a dog in the hunt. I certainly didn't. I mean, the Mets were out of it. Well, the Mets were out of it in May, for God's sakes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's the joy of the sport, because to me, it always harkens back to being a child. And the you know, the child's game, as it were, lasts a lifetime. You know, when you're a kid, and there's something so unbelievably poetic and American about baseball.
Yeah.
That's all there is to it. I mean, you know, the famous painting of the three umpires standing in the rain, Casey at the bat. It doesn't matter. If you know your baseball history, you understand why you feel this way. It's a lifetime love, a lifetime passion. You know, I'm 52 now, and I've had that love since my grandfather sat me down at the age of four in front of the TV in the afternoon and said, you're going to watch history be made. And it wasn't the landing of man on the moon, because this was 1969. It was the New York Mets were about to win the World Series against the highly touted, highly probable Baltimore Orioles.
Yeah.
So, you know, you put that into a four-year-old's mind and it stays forever.
Yep. Right. And as well it should. And it, all of the history of the game and all of it is worth revisiting, especially now when something amazing happened. And it, you know, the thing about the salaries, I think, is a little overplayed in some ways, but really what it says to me is it doesn't matter. You know, the millions of dollars and the, you know, the money and the business end of the game doesn't make any difference. The magic is what happens on the diamond.
Two things I want to bring up about that. I want to go back to what you were saying about what was it, 10-inning game?
Yeah.
10-inning game. I actually went to bed because once – I mean, first of all, let me just preface it by saying I could not believe it when they tied it 4-4.
Yeah, same here. I thought it was done.
And then it was 7-4, and I said, Jesus, they let the opportunity slip away. And when I saw that Gurriel, of course, had tied it at 7-7, I said – there's no way that Houston can let this game get away. And sure enough, was at the top of the eighth inning, the Dodgers go ahead 8-7. That's when I turned it off and went to bed.
Right, because it's done.
So I wake up and I see that the score, what was it?
13-12.
And that Houston had won it, and I thought to myself, my God, that's resilience.
Yeah.
Well, absolute resilience.
It's funny, because when it became 7-4, I looked at the guy that was with us watching the game, and I said, this thing's going to end up 15-12. And if that ball in the bottom of the 10th had traveled another couple of feet, it would have ended up 15-12. It was this close.
The other thing is, if you follow baseball on a regular basis, and I'm not talking about a particular team, if you follow the sport, you saw last year that Houston was going to create something very special. Yep. Because that was when the fuse was lit. The way that they handled the Yankees in that one game playoff spoke volumes. Yeah, you know, the Cleveland Indians had an amazing team in 2016, which got them to the World Series, but you cannot discount the absolute tenacity of the Astros. And going back to what you said about game sevens and the home versus away advantage or question, you know, Cleveland was on home territory. They could have dispensed with the Cubs, and they didn't. The Cubs were the visiting team, and the Cubs were the ones who wound up winning the damn thing. You know, thankfully, we don't have to celebrate them winning again, because that would have just made me nauseous. Nice to know that they were vanquished actually earlier than expected. But having said all that, I thought it was a great series, and I'm very happy for the people of Houston especially, because most importantly, with what they went through, this is truly, truly a very special thing. This is a gift.
One for the ages, to be sure. And, you know, outside of baseball, there was a lot else to watch, of course. And I mean, the big news that broke over the weekend while the games were being played was that the indictments had come down, the first couple. And I guess Friday they said the indictments were going to be unsealed on Monday. And sure enough, they were. And to nobody's surprise at all, it was Paul Manafort and his buddy who were the first thrown under the bus in this thing. I don't know how much longer this is going to go on. I know it's not a quick process by any means, but you have to believe that if this kid who pled guilty was indeed, yeah, Papadopoulos, if he was indeed wearing a wire and taping phone calls and all of this other stuff and piling up evidence for Mueller's prosecution while they were getting all of this done before the indictments came down, that they wouldn't have gone ahead with the indictments of Manafort at all had it not been for evidence leading farther up the chain.
Well, the most stunning revelation, which nobody's really been talking about, is the fact that he was arrested and basically confessed to everything in May.
Right.
And he's been, so hats off to Mueller for doing such a stupendous job in keeping this really, really quiet.
Bingo. Right. Yeah. How do you do that in Washington, D.C. without alerting anybody, except for the fact that, of course, the people that would have to be alerted about this are incredibly stupid and have egos the size of Jupiter?
Well, there you go. It's what you said is absolutely true, though. This is not a quick process. You have to remember, since I'm older now, my memory does tend to fail in terms of a perfect linear timeline, but the first rumblings that I can remember about Watergate, conspiracy, cover-up, Nixon White House was around late 72, just after the elections.
Right.
So it didn't unfold or unravel completely until really late 73, 74. Mm-hmm. So you had to endure a year and a half before 74, when basically, you know, the thread was pulled and the sweater just fell apart.
Right. But you have to remember, too, at that point, Nixon was 6 years into his administration. Donald Trump is not even a year into his. And this is all starting to unravel.
Well, the thing is, he also came into this administration under a very, very dark cloud.
Right, under scrutiny, if not under full investigation, sure.
Right. So, you know, look, Trump has been investigated for years. You know, wouldn't it be nice, I hate to say it, not good for the country by any stretch, because we really don't need these kinds of headaches and embarrassments and distractions, but wouldn't it be nice to just be able to actually clean out and flush the swamp by the people who were saying that they wanted to drain the swamp to begin with? Because the blatant hypocrisy of such a thing when the guy isn't even a politician, which seems to be what everyone forgets first and foremost.
Right. Well, and the other thing is about Manafort himself personally is, even though he doesn't really look it, the man is almost at 70 years old. So how much can you really, well, how much on one side can you really threaten a guy who is 68, almost 69 years old? And on the other hand, how much does he really want to go to prison? I mean, how much of a carrot is it for you to say, look, we have you dead to rights. We know you evaded taxes. We've got everything chapter and verse. And if you read the indictment, every penny is accounted for. Mueller is buttoned up on this one. And if they look at him and say, look, we've got you. If we want to, we can put you in prison until you draw your last breath, or you can roll. How hard is it going to be to get somebody like Manafort, who's a crook anyway, to roll on the people up the chain?
Well, it's a good question, because he's also an enemy of the United States, if you look at it on the technical side.
That's right.
You know, I mean, he's basically a haint for the Russians. So that's an enormous question mark. You know, could somebody get to him from the Russian side and have him whacked? Because they don't want this thing blowing up in their faces as well.
Yeah, he's on house arrest. I would stay in the interior rooms of that house.
Yeah, just don't move. Go to the bathroom and stay on the couch. End of story. Don't pick up the phone.
Right.
You know? Would they finally, and I'm saying finally after 40 plus years, finally nail Roger Stone to a cross once and for all? Because God knows he's as culpable as anyone is for everything.
Right.
Since the Nixon days, for God's sakes. We're just going to have to sit this one out, make a lot of popcorn, get a lot of soda, and wait and see. That's it. You know, it's like watching a bad movie.
Right. Well,
this is train wreck viewing.
And as you said, I mean, none of this is good for the country, but I mean, the country is doing whatever it can to rip itself apart independent of Donald Trump. And if I hear one more person say, well, you can't say that, I'm going to take out my pocket constitution. I'm going to whack him in the face with it. You can say anything. There is no punishment for speech. And granted, when you get into the international realm, that doesn't do us a whole lot of good. But here in this country, you can say anything you want. And, you know, Stephen Fry, the fantastic comedian and actor, has this great spiel that he does about people being offended. And it ends up with, so you're offended. So fucking what? You know, I just can't stand it anymore with people saying, well, you can't say that in this argument. Yeah, you can.
Well, no, you can't, because they're right and you're wrong.
Right. Of course.
John, get your head out of your ass. Where have you been? It's the Facebook mentality.
Right.
You're not a social justice warrior pussy. Okay.
Uh-huh.
That's the bottom line. And I don't think either one of us are really being funny or even sarcastic. Go on Facebook. And again, it's the home for everybody and anybody who thinks they have an opinion.
Right.
Or if they haven't formulated one yet, they're going to start braying like the sheep that are on there.
Right.
You know, whether it's political, whether it's whether it's sociology, whether it's an opinion on baseball, for God's sakes. They're going to slaughter you verbally because you don't agree with them.
Or heaven forbid, a joke. Oh, don't tell a joke.
Well, that's why most quote unquote comics who are out there right now are really unfunny.
Yeah.
You know, they're beyond tepid. It's because their collective balls have been cut off.
Yeah. And you know what's really hateful about that? I was just watching the other day for about the 100th time, the Lenny Bruce story. And it just, you look at what he did, you look at what he went through and what he had a fight against, you look at what Carlin went through and what Carlin had a fight against, and they were fighting the cops. They were fighting not going to prison. And now we have comedians who don't even have the balls to stand up to hecklers. Oh, come on.
Well, isn't that part and parcel of what seems to have taken over this country in reality?
Yep. Yeah.
The new left?
Yep.
That's, you know, as much of a dolt as Donald Trump is, he said, you know, political correctness is okay, but ... I'm sorry, political correctness is a misnomer and horseshit.
Yeah.
It's not political correctness. It's called kowtowing.
Right.
You know, and I refuse to kowtow. I don't go out of my way on this show or when I write or when I talk to people to be an asshole, to be a smart aleck. No, I go out of my way to make sure that when I'm stating something, I'm talking from fact. Because if it's one thing I don't like, it's to be misled. So if I'm going to say something, I'm going to come to you with enough in the conversation that I can certainly back up what I say. And if you don't like it nor agree with it, well, there's the proof. You can go and look it up yourself. God forbid you take 5 minutes to research something. Actually do the homework.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many people are out there, you know, raising holy hell over some of the stories that are coming out about either, you know, more of the sexual harassment thing or, you know, you know, more of Bernie Sanders bullshit and that stupid asshole who used to be the president of Hunter College, Donna Brazile. She's a fucking shill for Sanders, too.
Right.
But she denies all of this stuff. She was bought and paid for by the Russians. There's your facts. Bought and paid for, and it's already accounted for, but you don't want to hear it?
Right.
I'm sorry, newsflash. Hillary Clinton lost the election, and Barack Obama is not your fucking president, okay? He was the president. Because if that's the case, then, well, Richard Nixon's my president. Oh, I have one dick's eye view. Oh, getting a Jew.
Yeah, well, and see, that's the thing. I would rather have you call me a kike, Mick, whatever, you know, than you lie to me. You know, call me whatever the hell name you want.
Don't forget, John, you can't say words because words are as hurtful as hitting somebody.
Yeah.
No, not really.
Bullshit.
I mean,
yeah, right.
Case in point. If you and I were, if you and I were to call each other kike Mick, it would be kind of lame because we're both
kike Micks. Yeah, exactly.
So that's like, where are we going with this?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But still, but okay, if I was to hit you with a baseball bat and you were to pull a Negan on me, we'd both be pretty fucked up afterwards.
Exactly. Yeah, and was
so,
it...
Who break your bones. Words? No. Don't be a pussy.
Right.
Grow up, people. No. I don't want any negatives on my wall. No, but you can spew the negatives, you bunch of wheedling douchebags.
Right. And I'll tell you know who, if you look at the progression of events, it's interesting how this all played out, because the one guy who ought to be really happy that Hollywood is now solely focused on sexual harassment and assault and rape and all of that, and how many people are probably guilty of doing it over the years, is David Cross. Because keep in mind, when the Harvey Weinstein thing broke, David Cross was in the middle of being raked over the coals for making an Asian joke 15 years ago.
And who threw him under the bus? His fucking wife.
Yeah, exactly. Because it was one of her friends. And, oh, geez, it was horrible. And so this guy, I mean, he was facing... The light at the end of the tunnel was a gorilla with a flashlight coming at him, and he's facing all of this, and then all of a sudden nobody's paying a bit of attention to him, and he has to be breathing the biggest sigh of relief right now because the social justice warriors were on his ass.
By the way, have you ever read any interviews with Amber Tamblyn? She's a certifiable moron.
Oh, no,
so
I haven't.
I will grant you, David Cross is kind of a dick, and I don't think he's funny. But that being said... You throw your husband under the bus?
Yeah.
Shit. If you're going to throw your spouse under the bus, make sure it's an actual bus so you can collect the insurance money, because that's the only reason why you do something like that.
Right.
You don't go out there and you castrate them, you know, in the press. What is that going to do for you? Well, I'll tell you what. I'm putting my odds on that marriage will be over very shortly.
Yeah.
The divorce is definitely going to be pending. But, you know, to get away from the whole – Hollywood thing, because I'm so sick and tired of it. And by the way, when you were watching the thing on Lenny Bruce, you weren't watching Dustin Hoffman as Lenny Bruce,
oh, yeah.
Were you?
I actually was. That terrible, terrible sexual harasser, Dustin Hoffman.
Oh, that bad. I just can't. I don't care what anybody says. You know what? He's Dustin Hoffman. He can do whatever the fuck he wants.
He can grab my ass if he wants. It's fuck fine. Yeah. I'm okay with that.
He's Dustin Hoffman. He was fucking Benjamin Braddock. He was a little big man, for Christ's sakes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he's Ratso Rizzo. Do we really need to go down the list? He's Dustin fucking Hoffman. Fuck you all. I know what it is. They're all coming after him because he's a Jew. You notice they're all Jews. Harvey
Weinstein.
Brett Ratner. Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah.
Oh, but then there's Kevin Spacey. We haven't had a chance to talk about Kevin Spacey.
Oh,
yet.
Yeah. Right. Well, first of all, I mean, how about – were you as floored as I was when he came out of the closet?
What?
Kevin Spacey's gay. I just,
He's not gay. He's just well spoken.
Yeah, right. You think of how many signs must we have missed along the way?
I don't believe it. I refuse to believe it.
Oh.
You're telling me Kevin Spacey's a fagala?
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. But
he's from New Jersey.
I just don't even, I can't, I just, I, the whole thing is so incredible. And, you know, 15 years ago, I was talking with a friend of mine and he had been in Hollywood covering some event for somebody. I don't remember what it was. And he was talking at that time because Kevin Spacey had just done a late night TV appearance, probably with Letterman, wherein
was it when he did Pacino?
No,
sitting there.
It was when he said, "Please, everybody, stop saying I'm gay. My mother is you're starting to believe you," or some shit like that. His mother was horrified by the idea that people thought he was gay, and he said on TV, "I'm not gay." And of course, we're all sitting there looking at him, going, "Really?" but this buddy of mine who had been out there, he said, "Yeah, everybody that he talked to said, oh yeah, Kevin Spacey's grabbed every ass in Hollywood, every male ass in Hollywood." So it's like, you know, not only did everybody, the glass closet thing was an open secret, but everybody knew that all he did was get drunk and try to get every young male so that he could come over and grab his schwants.
Now, here's the problem, though. This comes out of Anthony Rapp, who I can't stand.
Yeah.
You know
yeah.
why? Rent.
I forgot that. That's where he came from.
Whence it comes. Rent.
Right.
What the fuck was a 14-year-old boy doing at a party
right.
full of men?
Uh-huh.
Can you explain that to me?
Yeah, I know.
Next!
Right.
Here's the thing, whether it's Spacey or if it's Hoffman or Jack Nicholson, how come Jack Nicholson's not been dragged out? I mean, he's not only grabbed every ass on the planet, he's grabbed them by the pussy.
Right.
You know? Who gives a shit anymore? You know what? Y'all negated it. You've all negated everything with the actions over the last couple of weeks and all the hand-wringing and your hashtags, because you know what? Nobody gives a goddamn anymore. We've got bigger fish to fry. And you know what that bigger fish is? We had a terrorist attack in New York City on Halloween.
Yeah, right.
We're going to call it what it is, because it's the exact same kind of attacks that went on in London and in Barcelona and in Berlin. It was a Muslim attack, okay? A Muslim extremist who screamed Allah Akbar as he got out of the truck that he had rented and ran away.
Yeah.
Because he was a pussy. He didn't stand there, you know, maybe trying to blow himself up and blow up the truck and try and take out more lives. No, no, no. He was starting to run when the police thankfully shot him.
Yeah.
He's an arrogant fuck, and I hope to God that he's executed.
You know what my favorite...
Let's not...
Yeah. Well, you know what my favorite thing is, though, about this is that now that he's caught and he's in jail and they're whacking him over the head with telephone books and all that shit, he's being an arrogant prick and saying, "Oh, I want an ISIS flag in my hospital room," and saying that, "Oh, I wish I had killed more people," and all of this. And people are reporting this breathlessly with, "You won't believe what he said." Really? The murderer surprises you because he's an asshole? Where are you from? What are you like that guy says makes you... I mean, what would surprise me is if they said, you know, granted, he killed a whole bunch of people in New York and drove through a bunch of people on bicycles and rammed his truck into a bus full of disabled kids, but it turns out he's a really nice guy.
You know, this is part and parcel of what... It doesn't even pass as, but it calls itself news reporting.
Yeah.
The disgrace of what is news reporting now.
Right.
And at the same time, it feeds and fuels the flames of the assholes on Facebook and all the social justice warriors who immediately go out of their way to say, if there's going to be any kind of anti-Muslim sentiment posted on my wall, you can unfriend me. Good, because I'm going to unfriend a lot of people. Fuck you. And right. if you don't like it, go join ISIS.
Yeah, and don't tell me what to say. Don't tell me what to think about it. Just don't.
On my fucking turf, because I worked in that neighborhood, one of my dearest friends was in school watching the whole thing unfold because she was at BMCC.
Yeah.
Stuck in lockdown for 3 hours while the FBI, you know, completely searched the area afterwards. You know, this has to be called what it is. My problem now, unfortunately, is in something that people pointed out quite rightly. I agree with President Trump, and this is when I'll actually call him President Trump. You know, he should be executed. But by saying that now, they could use that as a means of getting him off.
Right.
That's the price. He shouldn't have said it. You know, I know why he said it. You say it, I say it, we're all saying it. And he was in a right mind, okay?
Right.
And I don't mean right-wing people, okay? Listen carefully. Listen to what we're saying. Take what we're saying at value. Someone who's in the correct state of mind and understanding that this person is the enemy. He's an enemy of me and you and everyone else. And if you want to stand there and say, oh, he's misunderstood, I'm going to get out of the way when he rams a sword into your stomach, because let him take you out instead of me.
Right. I think you tell him how much you understand him. And I actually, you know, just to show the level of discourse and how stupid it is. And again, mean doesn't mean anywhere near as much to me as stupid does. When I'm trying to figure out who somebody is, you can be a prick. I don't care. Just don't be an idiot. And it's the same way as you can call me any name you want to, just don't lie to me. And when earlier today I was listening to one of these idiots, I don't know if it was CNN or MSNBC or whoever, it doesn't matter, they're all the same and they're all just as dumb. And they had the guy who was on the right and the guy who was on the left. And the guy who was on the left was saying, oh, you know, don't judge everybody by this one guy. And the guy on the right actually said, well, you know, it's not like we have white supremacists driving trucks through crowds of people. Really, shithead? Were you not around in Charlottesville? I mean, of all the examples you could use.
What a room.
Yeah, right. But, you know, that again, just don't be stupid. You can be a jerk, just don't be dumb. And you can't count on anything from anybody.
I certainly stopped watching MSNBC because, you know, my main man, Mark Halperin, is another one that was taken off the air because of sexual harassment.
Right.
Notice, he's a Jew. They're out to get all of us. I'm telling you, John, they're coming for you. They're coming for me.
Well, I promise.
You know what? I'm going to sexually harass you. How do you like that?
I was going to say, I'll stop grabbing your ass anytime you want. Just say the word.
You know, if I fondle your junk, it's just playful. That's all it is to do. You know, I got those wandering hands. I can't help myself. There, folks, look, we're sexually harassing each other. We're talking obscenely. Ooh!
That's right. I am so offended right now. I can't even tell you, because I'm not. So, now, elsewhere...
You're going to get me because I'm a Jew.
That's right. Now, outside of the outrage world, there are some things happening. And, you know, while everybody else was distracted by the World Series and some of the entertaining stuff that's been going on, I know this means a lot to you, and I'm still trying to catch up, and one of these days I'll actually get to it, but Walking Dead came back again. So what is the iteration this time? Is it still just The Walking Dead, or are we fearing The Walking Dead? What are we doing?
Well, the fearing of The Walking Dead is Los Angeles, and they're all The Walking Dead anyway, even right now in real life. So that goes without saying. No, this, you know, it's not like I'm into the thing, but because Liz, my wife of 19 years, loves the show and watches it, of course I watch it with her.
Sure.
Because at this point there's nothing on in competition on Sunday nights. By the way, The Deuce just wrapped up its first season, a terrific show. I hope the ratings were good enough that they will carry through and back for the second season, even though they announced a second season. Don't trust HBO.
Okay.
Because obviously they fucked us with Quarry, and I think they fucked us with Outcast. So having said that, Walking Dead came on, season opener was just, even to me, just, you know, a casual observer, was absolute gangbusters. It came out of the shoot filled with action and intensity and ferocity, and so far two episodes in, we're two episodes to the good. So, and I think it must have stormed the ratings in a way that it didn't even expect to, because you know, there's a show that's on right afterwards with that little narbo, Chris Hardwick. He always does the talking shows,
yeah.
You know, after everything on AMC. But opening night show, they actually had to do it at the Greek Theater.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And they had the whole cast there to boot. You know, that doesn't often happen. And even a couple of former cast members showed up. And it's a live show. But we're talking about the Greek theater. You know, when you say to me the Greek theater, there's only one thing that comes to mind, and that's Neil Diamond.
You're right.
You know?
Yep.
It was phenomenal. So again, you know, two shows in, and I am looking forward to seeing how this season unfolds. You know, don't forget, it's not a long season. It's only like 6 or 7 episodes per, which is why it has this kind of thing where it, you know, it leaves you wanting.
Yeah.
Which is the smart thing to do. Plus, I think they're getting to the point where they know they have to close out this ongoing story arc of the obvious bad guy needs to be taken out. So having said that, if you're a casual observer like I am, you're going to enjoy it. It's a fun hour's worth of watching.
Cool.
So,
good. Well, like I said, one day I will catch up and get to where you are. I just haven't done it yet, and I know the show is quality. I know it's had its ups and downs over the years, but still, you put zombies on TV, I'm a happy boy. Now, I do have to mention one quick thing, because we were dumping on Anthony Rapp a little while ago. I think if you could come up with a guy who is the polar opposite of him, who is the absolute coolest, and by the way, proudly representative of the city of New York, as you are, Rob Ross. I had the chance to talk with Michael Rappaport this week. What a cool guy he is, man.
Asshead!
Yes! He's just great. He's got a book out, and it's a sports book. It's called This Book Has Balls, and it's funny, and he's hilarious, and he is just the coolest guy to talk to.
He's possibly my favorite meathead. He really
yes.
is obviously dead from the neck up, but every time I see him on TV, I can't help but laugh.
Exactly.
He was so good in that Bacacta Woody Allen. Notice Woody Allen. Another sexual harassment.
Right, and another Jew. Right.
See, Jew, not did you, Jew eat. Not
yeah.
did you, Jew. See, I heard it. You see conspiracy in everything, Max. Now, I love the fact that you brought up, you know, a couple of Jews representing New York, as we should.
Yep.
Because this is Honeytown, after all. You think I forget?
Yeah.
Like elephants, we never forget.
That's right.
We don't forgive. We harp on it. We dwell upon it. And then we'll get you later on with the guilt. Speaking of New York, we're a week out from the mayoral elections. And I don't know if you've been following the fun little storyline, but the scandals have been rocking de Blasio's administration. Pay for play, you had a guy, God help us all, guess what? He's an Orthodox Jew,
mm-hmm.
was basically flipped by the cops to tell us everything you know about de Blasio. And he said, yeah, I've got his email, his personal email address, and I've spoken to him on the phone, and here's the emails and so on and so forth. And de Blasio's denying it to the hilt. I've never met him, blah, 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 blah. Hopefully that will play a part in hurting. I fear that he is going to be reelected, God help us. But if this combined with his beyond criminally ineptitude, is that proper grammatical
works
structure?
For me.
All right. His ineptitude in handling of this terrorist attack here in New York, hopefully that'll hurt him some more too.
Yeah.
I don't see votes taken away from him. What bothers me so much about this election, if I can be quasi-serious for a moment and not go off on one of my tangents as I usually do, is the opponents. Bo Dietl, you can't take seriously. You know, he's been, in my mind, he's just a comedic actor buffoon. He's a really low-rent version of Donald Trump. You know, he spent years and years as being one of Don Imus' goofy foils. You know, he'd call into the show and, you know, be a goofball. You know, he's a third-rate, you know, independent film actor when he can get a gig. And he comes out there and he, you know, makes the whole spiel, you know, calls de Blasio Big Bird and so on and so forth, and makes fun of de Blasio with the way he eats pizza and so on and so forth. So that's nonsensical and it's a distraction. Nicole Malliotakis, who's the other opponent, is a councilwoman from Staten Island and parts of Brooklyn, because the vote goes Staten Island and Brooklyn, even though she is a Staten Island native and resident. The problem is when she speaks, she sounds like a moron. She may be smart, but she sounds like an idiot. And therein opens up two forms of resentment that I have. A, that she's from Staten Island, and this is what people think of Staten Island to begin with, which I really despise. On the flip side, it makes me cringe when I hear anybody, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, who sounds like such an illiterate moron who's running for a high office.
Right.
So, unfortunately, I have a feeling that de Blasio is going to win and we're stuck with this motherfucker for four more years. Hopefully, it will be a really shitty four more years because he's got to be run out of town one way or the other. You know, I hope the scandals destroy him, well, is what I'm hoping.
Yeah, and maybe New York can go back to being like a little bit more like Chicago and seeing most of the people in political power led away in handcuffs eventually.
Unless they wind up like it's Chicago and the guns come out again, like in the 70s.
Right.
You know, that's the other, you know, real possibility, because crime here has spiked in ways that I've never thought possible, you know, or certainly haven't thought possible in decades. You and I talked about how shitty my neighborhood has started to become again.
Yeah.
With all the miscreants, vagrants, and general scum of the earth suddenly being allowed to roam. You know, there's a hope, though, that in the local election, the Staten Island election, that we actually have a borough president who I feel actually goes beyond the title and does his job, and he does it in a way that is, and we're talking in the parlance of modern politicking, so keep that in mind, courageous, because he's a Republican and he'll cross party lines just to try and get what Staten Island needs.
Yeah.
Now, with de Blasio as mayor, it's not going to be heard, because even if it was a Democrat who was the borough president, de Blasio gives less than a shit about Staten Island. So he's never going to do anything for us.
Yep.
But borough president James Otto is a good man and an honorable man, and I will go to the mat for him any day of the week. And I am a card-carrying Democrat. I'm an ashamed Democrat and an embarrassed one, and I will cross party lines if I have to vote my conscience rather than what the party says. Certainly my vote is with Jim Otto, because I've seen his work and I've seen him frustrated. This is a man who, just to give you a very quick example, with all the problems that we've had with bridge closings during the weekends at the hands of that lovely outfit known as the Port Authority, closing the bridges to New Jersey so that way there's a congestion that's beyond description on Sunday nights for people trying to get back into Staten Island. As Jim Otto put it, our lovely neighbors in Perth Amboy now blocking their streets so people trying to return to Staten Island can't take shortcuts. You know, this is a guy who's got his feet on the ground and his eyes planted firmly on everything that's going on around him.
Yeah.
He's calling out the bullshit for what it is, and I tip my hat to him, and he has my vote and my utmost respect. And he's a Republican, and I will be voting for him.
Fingers crossed for you, man. And on that note, we head into music, because there's a lot to go over. And we've been, for the last, I don't know, five or six episodes in a row, going into some of the amazing music that came out in calendar year 1984, and the year that really changed things in terms of both the sort of post-punk and second wave, new wave affairs, and when music was really starting to once again figure itself out. And you saw a lot of bands come out with these albums that set a tone for them that they would follow for years and years into the future. Unfortunately, this week's band didn't have a chance to do that. What's our album for this week?
The album is Like This by the DBs. It was their entry into major label hopeful stardom. The DBs, as everybody knows, is one of my favorite groups. And their first two albums were only available, ironically enough, on import. You know, they were a New York-based band, even though they're from Winston-Salem collectively. But their two albums, Stands for Decibels and The Perfect Repercussion, only came out through an English label called Albion Records. Finally, somebody had the wisdom at Warner Brothers and their subsidiary Bearsville, which was run by a fellow named, I think, Albert Grossman, who had started the label in conjunction with Todd Rundgren, to sign the DBs. So now the DBs were on a major label, or major label-backed label, regardless, that had a very solid track record. and they recorded what I think of as a masterpiece like this. It, and I've said this to Peter Holsapple verbatim. I said, you want to talk about those "Oh, Let Me Up" moments when an album starts with an incredible 1-2 punch, because we were doing that in our conversation. I said, "Like This" begins with, well, first of all, "Like This" had two immediate big hit radio singles. And keeping in mind at the time, songs that were made for radio, you just knew them the minute you heard them. Like, okay, this one's going to be a single. This one's going to be the follow-up. Side one came with two immediate impact radio singles. The opening song, "Love Is for Lovers," which is one of the all-time best anything, bar none.
Yeah.
And it goes into probably my favorite song on the album, "She's Got Soul," which just has this incredibly great and crisp riff that just it just takes you to another stratosphere, you know? And then the next track,
"Spitting in the Wind." Now we walk along a pop of storm, strong enough so we don't have to stand back.
"Spitting in the Wind," funnily enough, though, which is just a great rocking number, that was being done by them in the, I think, the year, maybe 2 years prior to the album being released, while Chris Stamey was still in the band. And for those who don't know, and this is a very important element of this album, Chris Stamey, who had founded the DBs, left the group in 1982 for a solo career. So now it was under the helmsmanship solely of Peter Holsapple, who, as I've said before, I don't agree with him in his assessment that he's better as a second mate. I think he was just fine as a skipper. Just fine.
Right.
The thing is that this is an album in one of those very rare instances when it's a 1-2-3-4 punch, because right after "Spitting in the Wind" is one of the most gorgeous things you will have ever heard. What I considered immediately the second single. You know, I can hear the singles on an album before they're pulled. And "Lonely Is As Lonely Does" is as powerful and as heartbreaking a number, and something that's so universally relatable, that it, I think, is one of the finest songs ever written by anyone. There's an extremely painful, emotive, almost otherworldly version that Marty Jones had done. And, you know, it's just such an indescribably beautiful and poignant song. So just those four songs to get you started and your appetite whetted, it's just such a wonderful, wonderful feeling. I mean, you listen to all of Side One, you know, you listen to the first four songs. "Not Cool" is a great and nifty little rocker. The only one, and I know why it was done, but the only addition to this album and stuck on at the end of Side One was a cleaned up remixed version of "Amplifier," which was on Repercussion, which came out 2 years previously. That was done as an appeasement to the label. I get it. It wasn't necessary, but it still works. Especially this version just sounds better than the Repercussion version. Now, if you want to talk about the flow of an album when you turn it over to Side Two, "Spy in the House of Love" is another one of those instant Peter Holsapple classics. But then you do have a couple of shakier numbers. And I say that in all love, simply because if you go back through the DB's canon of the prior two albums, there was always the balance between Peter Holsapple and Chris Stamey's songs. These are all now Holsapples. You've got "Spy in the House of Love." "White Train" is a fantastic song which closes out the album, sung by Will Rigby in places. But if you had some of Chris Stamey's songs to offset the Holsapple tracks, this would have been a perfect album. Because A, you wouldn't have needed "Amplifier," certainly. And I've often wondered, if Chris Stamey hadn't left, what from his first solo records would have made it onto "Like This"?
And right.
I have to think that his most powerful and at this point best known solo pop tracks, like "Something Came Over Me" and "When We're Alone" and possibly "Face in the Crowd," those might have wound up on this record, and it would have just been flawless. But but it's a great album. And it came towards the end of the year, around September or so, maybe October of 84. And I remember seeing it in Bondi's at Park Row, which was the smaller record shop across from J&R Music World, and just saying, oh, I'm going to buy it right now. Sight unseen, sound unheard, I don't care. It's the DBs, it's brand new, and look at this, it's a domestic release. And you can always tell that people to this day will argue, and I say that with a great deal of appreciation, argue the fact that Like This is probably their favorite DBs album because it's a very accessible album.
Yeah.
Especially that first side. You know, Love Is for Lovers just goes almost beyond without description. It's a perfect song in every way, shape, and form. The sound, the lyrics, the catchiness, the hook, the melody, everything about it. The fact that Bearsville Records collapsed almost as quickly as that album came out is just one of the cruelest jokes in a musical lifetime. Well, because I would have pulled that single and hyped it to the skies to make sure that that band got a much-deserved hit, because that was, for all intents and purposes, a radio hit. And look, if you see the DBs playing nowadays, that is one of the songs they do. And having Chris Stamey in the lineup again and playing on that song, I'm telling you, there's your heart beats faster in the best possible way.
Well, there's the history of it, and that's RIT, okay? So we know that it was the label collapse that led to the demise of what could have been that rise to the top for the DBs. But there's something else, and it goes right back to what you said way at the beginning of this conversation about the fact that, you know, now all of a sudden they have the label support, they have the technical support. This was not a DIY kind of affair of an album. But we've seen it happen before where a band will get that first shot in a real studio with real producers and a real engineer and all of that. And what ends up happening is it takes the life out of the band. It makes them sound exactly like everything else that came out of that same studio with those same engineers. And this avoided that. And that's, again, part of what this series about 1984 was all about, is that there, so much lightning was caught in a bottle that year. So in your mind, listening to this with a critical ear, how did they avoid that sameness when they came out with that first album that really had all of the pieces in the right place?
That's a good question. I think probably because they didn't adhere to any particular rules. They didn't sit around listening to their contemporaries.
Yeah.
You know, they just went ahead under, I would surmise, a great deal of duress, doing this for the first time on a major label with a bit more finance behind them, but minus one of their key components. So I think by not thinking about that side of it, they just focused on the songs. That and the fact that they knew the songs inside and out.
Right.
It wasn't a case of going into the studio and we need to bang out an album, pressure is on. You know, the songs were already in pocket, and they had them.
And they also weren't novices. I mean, these they had done this before. They knew what it was about. So when you go in with that kind of experience under your belt, even though they were still relatively young men, you can see it when something's going the wrong direction, and you can stand up for yourself and say, no, we're not going to do it like that.
Or in this case, Like This.
Yeah, there you go. That is Like This from the DBs. And again, well worth the revisit if you haven't in a while. And you said the DBs are back and doing their thing with Chris Stamey back in the lineup. So is there touring? Is there talk about going out and getting outside of New York?
I think it would be a case of, at this stage, just to give you a very quick update on them, they got back together with Chris around 2005, 2006 I'm going to call it on a full-time basis with him back in the fold in the original lineup. Being that they're all older and they're all relocated down to North Carolina, they don't come up here that often anymore. Gene Holder, the bass player, lives in Philadelphia because he owns a studio there. But when they are willing to travel and play, they all have families and they all have day jobs and so on. They do play at the main places you would expect to see them. The last time I saw them, in fact, was at Maxwell's in 2012. They put out an album for the first time in 30 years at that point called Falling Off of the Sky, which picked up where Repercussion had left off, because it was the four-piece DBs who still had it. No different than they had it before.
Yeah.
You know, they still had that same wonderful, buoyant magic. Turing is something I don't think they would do, because unless there was an incredible package offered where it could be completely affordable and they could take time off from work and away from the families, I don't think they're going to be doing that. But you never know when they're going to pop up, because they do tend to pop up. And that's the great thing. But at least we can sleep better at night knowing that the DBs are still out there one way or the other, doing something at some point. And, you know, it's always a joy to hear anything out of Mr. Holsapple and Mr. Stamey, who, in fact, is coming out with a book. But we'll talk about that on the next show.
Yeah, well, and there's a couple of guys right now who are taking the act out on the road again for the first time in a long time. And you had some thoughts about this, because I know, as big fans as we both are of Paul Weller and Bob Mould, there are some things being said about them that have been said about them since, well, since probably 1984. And it's about time for all of this to stop.
Well, here's my take on it, because they're both older, as we are. They have already established themselves with these wonderful, powerful, lengthy solo careers. We don't need to talk about what they did before. It speaks for itself.
Yep.
But now there's this onslaught, and I find this to be an embarrassment more than anything else. Of people saying, well, why don't they reform the Jam? Why don't they reform Who's to Do? Well, unfortunately now, that can never happen because of Grant Hart's death.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that. They're both doing their thing. And at the same time, when you see them perform live, they're giving the people more than what they want. You know, Paul Weller is very content and very gracious in pulling out the chestnuts from the Jam catalog and from the Style Council catalog. Bob Mould gives you some pretty damn near-perfect renditions of old Husker Du songs, Sugar songs. So to give them both short shrift because you're getting older and you're now going into this infantile state of musical uppityness, I think is doing a great deal of disservice to them, to yourself, and to what once was the punk community. And I take a lot of umbrage now, it seems, with my former brethren in the punk scene, which is why I very firmly and somewhat painfully refer to myself as an ex-punk. For me, punk rock was religion. It truly was. You know, everybody has their moments when they find Jesus, they find Krishna, they find Buddha, whatever. When punk rock came into my life at the age of 12, it was my religious conversion. But now I feel like I'm atheistic about it, because all the old punks seem to have not grown up. No, let me retract that. Not all of us. There are some who maintain a sense of perspective. It's just this loudmouth coterie of those who think they're still in the know. If you're going around at the age of 54, 55 with a leather jacket on and your gut hanging out over your pants and spiked or dyed hair, you look like a moron. And I'm pretty sure that what you're going to say is equally as stupid as the way you look.
Right. Well, and here's the thing is, what would be the point? And this is where it really starts to bother me. Could you find the guys in the Jam and put them all in a room together, or even make them go out on tour again? Sure, you could do that, but what would be the point? Because the only thing you could possibly have come out of that is yet another nostalgia tour. Is that what we want to turn punk into, is another, you know, the Moody Blues doing their 35th tour in the last 20 years, you know, and just playing the same hits? Do you honestly think that you can put that outfit back together and have new brilliant music come out of it? Or is it better to let somebody like Paul Weller, at the age that he is now, do what it is, where the next wind takes him, and let him do what he's always done, which is create out of nothing and go on to the next thing?
I will take your statement and I'm going to extend it, because you're beyond correct. Aside from it being, would it be just another nostalgia tour? It would only be for the money.
Right.
That's all there is to it.
Yep.
Could you put the three members of the Jam in the same room? I'm not sure. Because of the tension between Rick Buckler and Paul Weller, if I could have one wish for them, it would be that they could be in the same room and actually become friends again and just leave it at that.
Right.
They don't need to make music. They don't need to reform the Jam. Funnily enough, as important and, dare I say, as sacred, and I say that very strongly in very large letters, bold and in neon, as sacred as the Jam were to me. I'm glad that they were the one band that never got back together again, because the one thing that the Jam stood for more than anything else was youth. And to see a 57, 58-year-old Paul Weller singing When You're Young is mortifying. And you know people would want to hear it, people of our age range. And I cannot accept that nor digest it. I don't sell Bruce Foxton short on the fact that he's in a group called From the Jam, which was actually started originally by Rick Buckler as a Jam cover band called The Gift. They brought Bruce in, changed the name to From the Jam, went out on tour. They were fantastic when I went to see them. What I thought was wonderful, it was their way of saying thank you to all the fans that didn't get the chance.
Right.
So even though you've got two other supplemental players, it's still Bruce and Rick, because as the line always went, there were three people in the Jam and two of them weren't Paul Weller. Now, Weller going out and doing what he does is all I want to see and hear. And that's it. I am fine with it.
So when it comes to the Jam, what you're saying is it's about the young idea? I'm sorry, I had to. It was sitting right there.
You know, I would not, and this is a bold statement, if that were to ever happen.
Yeah.
In the most bizarro fashion, in a linear universe, I would not go to see them, because I don't think I want my memory sullied like that. And
yeah,
I'm telling you right now, the two bands that I'm glad never did that was the Jam and the Teardrop Explodes.
Mm-hmm.
It would just not be – it would be uncomfortable. It would be painful, because I want to remember it the way it was, you know? It's kind of like the whole theory about the Beatles. Yoko Ono said something once about the Beatles were like the Great Coliseum. A guy burned it down while it was still pristine and beautiful because he couldn't stand the thought of it getting old.
Mm-hmm. Well, right.
That's the way of looking at it.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the best example of that is the Saturday Night Live story. When Harrison was on SNL and Lauren Michaels went out and offered $3,000 for the remaining Beatles to come down. And John and Paul happened to be sitting in John's apartment watching. And they actually considered doing it. But you know what? That story is 1,000 times better because they didn't than it would have been had they had 3 minutes back on Saturday Night Live together.
It's a bit chintzy, isn't it?
Yeah, right. Now, on that, there's something else that happened. And this is great because unbeknownst to you, it's actually going to lead into a conversation we're going to have on our next edition of the program. But you had something cool happen. And I have no idea what this is because you haven't told me yet. But I wanted to hear it right from you, because there's a band that, first of all, is fantastic. And second of all, has a degree of fame outside of the music world inside the band. And all I know about the Action Skulls is what I read from your review and what I've heard online since then. So let's start from there. Who are they?
The Action Skulls are a trio of just old friends, for a start. One's a married couple. But it's a trio of old friends, and they happen to be John Cowsill on drums, as in the Cowsills, who he also right now plays drums for the Beach Boys.
Mm-hmm.
His wife, the lovely Vicki Peterson of the Bangles, and this is great, Billy Mummy, as in the great actor from Lost in Space, Will Robinson, and of course his most famous role, Little Anthony from the Twilight Zone, the famous "You're bad. You're a bad man, and I'm going to wish you into the cornfield."
it's real. It's real good, isn't it, Anthony? Boy, it sure is good.
I think I'm going to make some television.
Oh man, what a fantastic piece of work that was!
I should point out, a lot of people don't realize Billy Mummy's a very long-standing musician, and in fact, is part of the now legendary Barnes and Barnes, who gave us all fish heads, roly poly fish heads,
eat them up, yum.
So, you know, he's got quite the pedigree in music. And they did this record, which is just absolutely stunning. It's funny because the name belies the sound. It's this fantastic and fantastic sounding roots rock kind of album.
Yep.
Everybody sings. They all take turns. Some of them do what I call cycling in the song, where one sings one verse, the next one sings the next verse, and so on.
Very Traveling Wilburys-ish.
Yeah, yeah. Lively, fun. Very poignant in the fact that the gentleman who played bass for them had passed away before the album was completed. a gentleman named Rick Rosas, who is a very much in-demand session bass player in the LA scene. You know, he worked with people like Joe Walsh, Neil Young, and so on and so forth. So they finished off this album, released it, and it's just fantastic. I mean, really, it's the kind of album that when you listen to it, it picks up your spirit.
You gotta be there when I call your name. You gotta be there when I call your name. Ain't got no peace of mind when you're hard to find. You gotta be there when I call your name. Oh yeah. I told you once, I told you twice.
Yeah, it just in the harmonies that they're able to put together in different kind of formations, there's something else there that you won't find with a lot of bands.
And the thing is, it sounds very fresh. It doesn't sound like older people, if you will, or, you know, that kind of thing where people, you know how, especially in this day and age, critics, notice I'm using the quotation marks thing with my fingers in the air.
Right.
Critics will always give that sarcastic, well, no. It's a very fresh sounding album. Lively is the word I use most often. You got to hear it. If you haven't heard it, well, you've heard it. You love it. I love it. It's a great record. It's one of my favorite albums out this year. Pure and simple, hands down. The Action Skulls. A funny name for a band that doesn't sound, which is a great contradiction.
Yes, right. But something happened. So you wrote the review, and again, a very positive review that's up online right now, elsewhere on Popdose. And then what?
So, and this is the part that nobody seemed to, so only one person figured it out and got it. And I'll get to that afterwards. So I sent the link to the review to their publicist, who's a wonderful person. And a terrific publicist. He's, you know, like us, he's from the old school, the old guard. He's a total pro, but he's a great guy. And I always like to send him the link so he can tweet it out and, you know, and so on. So I send him the review. And within maybe 10 minutes, and he's out in California, I get a reply back from him. He goes, well, here's something for you. I'm like, okay. And I open up the email, and it's the reaction from Billy Mummy. And it just simply says highlight in yellow. Well, that's real good. With a couple of skulls next to it, three skulls next to it.
Oh, he actually went back to the TV show. That's cool.
God bless him for doing that. It had me in stitches. And by the way, 5 minutes after that, Vicki Peterson also sent her pleasure at the review. You know, so that's great. I'm glad they liked the review because it's a wonderful album.
Yeah. Well deserved. And you know, the one thing that I saw from the publicity shots that you have there on the page and from watching some of the video is that Bill Mummy, for some reason, now looks a little bit like Paul Kantner without the chin.
Yeah, but he hasn't really aged much.
Yeah, I know. He does. You can still see it. If he walked down the street, even with the long hair and the John Lennon glasses on, you would think, boy, he looks like that kid from the cornfield episode on on Twilight Zone.
Well, you know, by the way, you do know that when they had the new Twilight Zone, they revisited
that
episode. It's still, again, it was his daughter who played Anthony's daughter. Oh. Anthony is basically normal at this point, trying not to remember what he'd been like as a child, but she's like that, and he's trying to combat her until the very end.
I'll have to check that out. No, I didn't know that. And well, and that was also, they remade that episode as part of the Twilight Zone movie back in, what, 83, I think, or 82. And that was really well
done. There was also actually another variation on it when they tried the first revival of Twilight Zone in around 86, 87.
Right.
When it was, you know, being revisited. But I posted this... My statement on Facebook was something like, and I'm just paraphrasing because I can't remember my own exact words, but it was something like, every now and then, even after all these years of writing reviews, it's nice to receive a reaction from an artist for their album and not get wished into the fucking cornfield. And I put the little wink next to it.
Yeah.
And a couple of people thought I was talking about them, you know, which is kind of wryly funny.
Yeah.
One friend of mine posted the picture of Anthony in one of those little memes that says, "You're a bad man, and I'm going to wish you into the cornfield." And I wrote underneath it, "Well, thankfully, the gentleman whose picture you've just posted above has no intention of wishing me into the cornfield at the moment, so I can breathe a little easier." Nobody got it.
Yeah.
Nobody figured out that that was the real deal.
That's funny.
And one person did, and that is the wonderful, incredibly talented, and just absolutely lovely Kate Brennan, singer, songwriter extraordinaire. She got it. Because she's got a great sense of humor. She knows what the hell is going on everywhere at every moment. She's an amazing individual. And she goes, "Well, listen, if he's still wishing people into the cornfield, I got a list for him." I just thought, right on.
Yep.
She knew the minute she got my connotation, and she was looking at the review underneath it. So she got it. One person out of so many responses. But yeah, so that was definitely one of the high water marks of my writing. You know,
excellent. Well done, and well deserved. And again, got to check out the album from the Action Skulls. Just listen through to it once, and you're going to be an instant fan. And that brings us into our In Our Heads. And by the way, that conversation, as we said, leads into something that we'll go over on the next edition, on edition number 38 of Radio City. Because of a dinner that happened not even 24 hours ago, and I'm still trying to process exactly how all of this went down. So we'll have that full story for you on the next edition of the broadcast. But we have our In Our Head segment to get into this time around. And, you know, this one, it just so happened every so often my little iPod or my iPhone or whatever that I'm using in the car will pick out the same song either twice in a row, or it'll play it and then play something else. And then, you know, a couple of songs later, it'll pop up again. And this time, you know, it's a song that seems like such a throwaway, but again, it perfectly encompasses that loose feel that shows you that a band, even one of the best bands in the world, can sit back and kick back and have a good time in the studio. Because my iPod played Bungalow Bill a couple of times within a few songs of each other. And I thought, you know, as much as I've always loved that song, I don't think I ever really appreciated it. And on that second go around, I started listening in really intently to, of all things, that the whistling that goes on toward the end of that song. And realize, first of all, that there's three of them doing it, because I always thought it was two, but there's actually three tracks of whistling that goes on. And even though it seems so completely discordant with the song, when they're all three put together, it works and it makes sense. But it sounds like such a goof off, and yet it shows you that even on the song that sounded like a goof off, there was a tremendous amount of headiness about what those guys were doing every time they stepped into the studio to record a song. So I wonder if there's been something like that for you, where a song that you liked and you just kind of, you know, shoved off into the background, all of a sudden gained a new life to you, and you went, you know what? I just heard something that I've never heard before, and that's brilliant.
I would actually say there are probably too many to name.
I know.
Let me just say one thing about that album. I've boiled it down to a single disc. I take out the extraneous crap from it. You know what I mean? Because as much as I love Paul, that whole theory of, "Oh, it's the White Album, it's a classic, it's the Beatles, shut up." No, Paul, you shut up, okay? Shut up. You gave us Why Don't We Do It in the Road.
Yeah, well, even Ringo said they should have made two albums out of it.
Or at least one album and cut the crap out of it.
Yeah, right.
Did we really seriously need Honey Pie, Wild Honey Pie? Did we need Revolution 9? You know, no, we didn't. We didn't need Why Don't We Do It in the Road. If you simply took it from, you know, let's say most of side one can stay intact. I probably would have done Bungalow Bill. But if you went from, let's say, USSR, Prudence, Obla Di Obla Da, Glass Onion, Guitar Gently Weeps, Warm Gun, that's side one.
Right.
Right there.
Yeah. And as long as I Will and Julia are on the other side, anything else is fine.
I Will, Julia, Blackbird.
Yep.
Right. Long, 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 which is the most overlooked song on that entire collection.
Agreed.
Helter Skelter and Cry Baby Cry, and their side two.
Right, and we're done. And that's it.
Exactly. You don't need anything else. Having said that, there are a couple of things that I have found over the years that, and these are songs that, you know, I can't qualify as having pushed into the background because they were probably there at one point or another, but Harmony, A City in the Sky by The Who, mm-hmm. which is the lead off track from The Who Sellout. When I got the very newly remixed, remastered version, because as well you know and as everyone else does, the original versions just sound everything by The Who never sounded good in terms of the original releases.
Right.
You know, Moon's drums could never really be heard and appreciated, nor Entwistle's bass. This was the first time that I was able to hear something that I never picked up on, and that it's Pete and Roger singing together in unison and in minor harmonies, but in unison.
If you ever want to lose some time, just take off. There's no risk. If you ever want to disappear, just take off and think of this.
Which takes the song to another psychedelic stratosphere, because it is one of the most psychedelic things I've ever heard in my life. And it made me love the song 10 times more than I'd done previously. I'd always thought it was just Daltrey.
Yeah.
And I realized it's Pete. And I'm thinking, wow, they're so in tune with each other that it makes it so much more enjoyable, right? Seesaw by The Jam, which was the flip side. It was a throwaway B-side for the single of the Eton Rifles. It was also given to a Scottish mod band called The Jolt for them to release as a single. That's a song where Bruce Foxton is singing lead vocals on a Paul Weller composition.
Yeah.
But then towards the end, Weller is singing lead, and I didn't realize it for, I'm going to say, like 30-plus years. It's little treasures and moments like that where you discover these little nuances that you just love. And I think That's really the key component. It's finding things that make you go, oh, well, wait a minute, let me listen to that again.
Well, yeah, and one of those, you know, in very similar fashion to that, and maybe it's just I'm the only person in the world who didn't get on the first listen through, but in both versions, both hit versions of I Fought the Law, the original Bobby Fuller 4 and the one that The Clash did years later, there's that slowdown rat-tat-tat drum hit on the robbing people with a six-gun line. And the reason that it does that and hits the snare like that, if you count them, there's six of them. It's six shots. That's what that referred back to. And I was like, oh, shit, I get it now.
You're deeper than I am, because I just don't have that kind of intellectual capacity to really dissect stuff like that. I'm the idiot that always picks up the little tiny bits and pieces, and I'm going to give you a really mundane example. We used to cover And Your Bird Can Sing just for laughs. Yeah, because it was four of us, so we could do it. And because I'm a dick, and this is what I think of. At the very, very end, especially if you're listening to it at a semi-loud volume, you hear the last throbs of the bass going, doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. And at the very, very, very tail end of the fade, you hear like a guitar note being plucked.
Mm-hmm.
Or where somebody moved his finger off the guitar string prematurely.
Right.
Whenever we played that fucking song, we made sure we did that.
That's great.
Stupid shit like that. Like, I once recorded a version of I Will, actually. And at the very end, I did the thing with the thump, thump, thump on my guitar. Because I'm a dick and I do these things.
Yeah.
It's the little nuances that always stay with you. You know, there's a little tiny, nobody really hears it, a little tiny, like, note that's hit during Norwegian Wood. We always made sure we put that in. It's just always put the details in place.
Right, right. And one of the ones that caught my ear because it's so completely discordant, and there's a ton of stuff. After listening through to everything Led Zeppelin did 400 times or whatever it was, you pick up on little nuances. Like in, I think it's in The Ocean, you hear the phone ring twice, And, you know, of course, that was all recorded in Page's house. So chances are it's just the phone rang, you know, and they were like, ah, it's buried in the mix. Nobody will hear it. And there's on Since I've Been Loving You, the original version of it, because they redid it for Coda. But on the first, I think it was Led Zeppelin 2 that song was on, you hear Bonzo's kick pedal squeaking through the entire fucking song. And it's such an obvious thing, but when you're just casually listening to it, you don't catch it. But the one that got me was I was listening back through to All of My Love, and on the keyboard solo in All of My Love, twice during the keyboard solo, John Paul Jones screws up and hits two notes at the same time. And if you know it and you listen for it, you're like, oh yeah, there it is, and it's blatantly obvious. But it's okay. You know, it fit the groove of the song. But somebody performing that live who played it clean, to me, it wouldn't sound right.
And, you know, it's funny. You're bringing up something that, to me, as a fan of producers as well, and I'm not going to go off on a huge tangent, but that's the kind of thing that comes right out of the Todd Rundgren production book. You know, how many things has he produced where you hear a doink or a note? Or, you know, just something bungled, and he leaves it in. It's like, nope, we got it. We got the feeling. That's all that matters, right? You know? Case in point, just the very opening notes of Open My Eyes by the Nazz. You know, his first band, Rundgren's first band. It's the opening coda of I Can't Explain, obviously, but if you listen carefully, unless you do pick it up just blatantly from the first listen, there's a bum note in there, you know?
Yeah.
I've always felt that bum notes give the song or keeps the song in that human realm. That's the problem I've always had, of course, when you get into things like auto-tune and MIDI, when that was becoming the whole big thing. It takes away the humanity of it. You know, right. You want to hear kind of, oop, tiny bit flat. Look, here's one of the most perfect things that I ever figured out. Going back to the original question. On the first single by The Punchline, The Wildflowers, I was under the assumption for however many years since we recorded it, it's now 30 years at this point, that it was me who goes a little flat on the chorus, the first chorus, right?
Yeah.
And it wasn't me. It was my bass player. He's the one who botched it up. So suddenly the guilt was lifted off my shoulders, but I was always conscious whenever we would do the song live, because I never wanted to make the same mistake with the note because it was so ingrained in my head as a mistake, you know? But it was he who went flat. But it took me forever to figure it out. It was our drummer who said, that's not you, that's Carl. I'm like, what? He goes, listen to each channel. I was like, well, I didn't listen to it because I fell asleep on the floor because we mixed it 90 times.
Right.
I didn't want to hear it again, you know? If that was the case, I would have pulled it out and said, no, let's have him go back in and recut it so that it's proper, knowing me. But there you go. It only took me 30 years of my own song to realize, oh, I didn't screw this up.
Well, good.
Bass player did it.
I'm glad you got your eventual resolve. And we've got plenty more to talk about on our next episode. And we're going to do things a little bit differently next time around and leave the script at home as though we have much of a script to begin with. But we're going to just kind of wing it. And we've got a whole bunch to go over. So in addition to one of the more interesting dinners I've had in a long time, we've got plenty more to go over. So make sure that you're around for it. Rob Ross, we'll see you next time around. Thanks for being here again. And have yourself a good week.
Absolutely, my brother. I cannot wait to hear this. The skullduggery is an amazing thing. But, yep, I will catch you next week. Have a good one and be well.